miss a minute. Listen at your leisure, always online and on demand at RadioMD.com. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
Our guest of this segment is Clifton Leaf. His book is called Truth in Small Doses, Losing the War on Cancer. Here's Dr. Mike Roizen. Dr. Mike?
Clifton, Truth in Small Doses, extremely interesting, and talks about cancer, but you don't talk about, for example, obesity or any of the things that regular people could do about this. And let me, meaning physical activity or obesity, at least I didn't catch it. And let me go back and correct something since we were talking about obesity rates. When I look at 1990, no state in the U.S. had more than 15% obesity. Now, no state has less than 20% obesity, and only one state has less than than 25%. Let me go through and ask you, how much of the war on cancer is due to, or the lack of winning the war on cancer is due to things like obesity, lack of physical activity, and our food choices?
You know, it's a great question, and thank you for having me on the show. It's great to be here. You know, I think that there are two elements here. The first is, you know, given that the medical science that we have, are we making the kind of progress that we could be making? And that has to do with, are we doing the things that we know helps prevent cancer and heart disease and other chronic killers? And the second part of it is, are we doing what we can to learn more and learn faster what we don't know? And so I spent a lot of the book on that second question about some of the barriers, academic barriers and really cultural barriers to being able to get more information, more research about what's causing many cancers and how to cure them. But getting to your question, which I think is a really important and meaty one, which is that, hey, we know a lot about how to prevent cancers, and we're not really doing much about it at all. And obesity is a big link in that. So, you know, obesity, of course, is related to some of the inflammatory processes that happen. And inflammation is one of those sort of crucial things that the body does well in wound healing, but it does badly, and when it goes terribly wrong, it can lead to cancer.
Now,
so I think that's an important issue.
Now, one of the things you talk about, or at least that you emphasize in the book, is at least from what I took from it, and was the lack of cooperation among scientists, and if you will, the small progress in cancers. You contrast this with the large changes in heart disease. Now, the pharmaceutical companies and the scientists were essentially very similar. I mean, they have the same motivations, they're the same companies often, they're the same, if you will, universities that do the science. Why did they come out with such big progress against heart disease? As you point out, the 30% or more decrease in heart disease, the 60% more decrease in the incidence of stroke, why did they do so much better? Is it just that the heart disease and stroke were much easier, or was there a difference in the mindset?
The mindset is very much, but I think it really actually helps to just even paint this for your listeners. You know, if you go back to 1970, and you know where we had 138,000 more deaths from heart disease in 1970 than we did in 2010, despite the fact that we have 100 million more people in the country, and we're older. And that we're heavier, as you pointed out. So that's a remarkable thing. Now, with cancer, you know, we have you know, many, many more deaths from cancer, and that has partly risen because of the increase in population and the older population. But what we did with heart disease was we thought of it as a process. It wasn't an event. It was a process. And so, you know, the mindset with cancer is very much that it's somehow an event. Like, you go to the doctor, and the doctor tells you, I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, I'm sorry, Mrs. Smith, the scans came back, you have cancer. And at that moment is when the clock starts. It doesn't just start for insurance payments And it starts for when the survival clock starts ticking, but it also starts in terms of our research and our efforts to deal with it. Rather than going back to what we did with heart disease, was we saw this is a long developmental process, and we have to do is intervene early with the symptoms, essentially, the biomarkers of a developing disease. In this case, high cholesterol, hypertension, those kinds of elements. And we really got people to address those early in the process of heart disease, and so people stopped dying of it. Fewer people that get the disease, the fewer that die of it.
But we don't have those same markers for cancer, or do we, do you think?
Well, in some cases we don't. And part of what I address in the book is what our failure is in terms of organizing in a way that we'll find them. In some cases we do. So what we've seen, for example, is a dramatic reduction in death from cervical cancer in the U.S., based in large part on early markers of cervical dysplasia.
Pap smears.
Yeah. It's incredible.
We have a vaccine, but we have a vaccine that is only 53%, I think, of young girls are getting it.
Yeah. Well, there's a great bang for the buck, Dr. Mike. I mean, a vaccine is the most effective public health intervention there is, and we really have to encourage more young women to get that vaccine because it will save lives.
Now, is there a difference in the way the pharmaceutical companies are approaching cancer compared to how they approached heart disease as well?
Yeah, I think the pharmaceutical companies in many ways get their marching orders, so to speak, from the way the FDA looks and evaluates the drugs that come to them for approval. So in heart disease, there was this real acceptance that the disease was a process, a developmental process. And so they allowed the treatment of those markers like high cholesterol. So when you look at what we've done in terms of this sort of anti-heart disease medicines, it's cholesterol medicines, Lipitor and Crestor and the whole rest of them, and antihypertensives as well. That's really where we've made the great strides. And in cancer, there still is this feeling like, oh, well, you can't treat healthy people. This idea that we can't preempt cancer is very much ingrained in the FDA mindset.
So the difference, if you will, let me go and elaborate on that for the listeners, if you will. The difference is we have what we call surrogate markers of the disease in heart disease and stroke. And those are, for example, LDL lousy cholesterol, or now triglycerides, or if you will, some other blood pressure. And in cancer, we look at what we require isn't just tumor size, usually. It is actually, does it prolong survival? So those are what we call outcome studies that are much tougher and much more expensive to do. It would be looking at a person who has a heart attack and saying, are they going to have fewer heart attacks over the next 10 years? Much tougher than what we call the intermediate variable studies to do.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. And so, I think there's part of the sense that, there's this unwillingness to act without certainty. We think that we're going to somehow have certainty about these surrogate markers. But back in the 1950s and 60s, we just didn't know that high cholesterol
we're going to have to come back and talk about this after the break. We're talking with Clifton Leaf, LEAF, the author of The Truth in Small Doses. And you want to go to his website, it's cliftonleaf.com. The Truth in Small Doses. We'll have more about cancer versus heart disease, or cancer and the problem of winning the war and how to win it when we return.
YouDocs@gmail.com, YouDocs@gmail.com. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show with Dr. Mike on Radio MD. Stay well.
Hi. Hi, this is Melanie Cole, show host here at Radio MD and a mother of two. I want parents to know about Great Start Life Insurance offered by Guarantee Trust Life Insurance Company. Great Start ensures the future insurability of your children. Now, what does that mean? Too often, people will get an illness or an injury at some point in their lives that afterwards can preclude them from receiving life insurance, and that can cause a lot of problems. But by insuring your children now with the Great Start Plan, the insurance that grows with your children, they'll already be insured regardless of future illness or injury. Find out all about the great benefits of the Great Start Plan. Go to GreatStartGTL.com and see for yourself why Great Start is, well, a great start for your kids. Peace of mind at GreatStartGTL.com. That's GreatStartGTL.com. For the Great Start Plan, go to GreatStartGTL.com.
Plan not available in all states. Life insurance underwritten by Guaranteed Trust Life Insurance Company, Glenview, Illinois.
Sometimes people buy cookies as a gift for us to send to our soldiers. They tell us it reminds them of home.
Emily is one of thousands of Girl Scouts who will send cookies to troops stationed overseas.
Children shouldn't have to take abuse because they aren't strong enough to escape it. I want to give them a helping hand.
Alicia uses proceeds from her cookie sales to provide mentoring programs at a shelter in her community.
Selling Girl Scout cookies has taught me how to manage money, be responsible, and talk to other people.
Tanya wants to go to business school and hopes to run her own company someday.
On a visit to the food bank, I learned that in this economy, more and more people need help to feed their families.
Morgan and other Girl Scouts are starting a project to help get food to those who need it most. Every Girl Scout cookie has a mission, to help girls do great things. Find your cookies now at GirlScoutCookies.org.
If you've missed a show, the full audio library is at RadioMD.com. And now back to you, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
Also on iHeartRadio Talk. Don't forget about that, iHeartRadio Talk. Clifton Leaf's book is called Truth in Small Doses, Losing the War on Cancer. And here once again is Dr. Mike Royson.
So let's finish this up, Clifton, and then we've got a series of quick questions from the email line. If you will, the major problem hasn't been the amount of effort compared, if you will, the pharmaceutical firms versus others, but maybe the FDA process in accepting surrogate markers and us not having good surrogate markers for the cancer chemotherapeutic agents.
Sure. I mean, it's not just the FDA. I think there's a whole broad academic mindset in cancer community that says, you know, we got to tackle this thing once it's sort of clear and obviously cancer rather than before. So, but the FDA is certainly a part of it. Yeah.
Now let me go and I'm going to quickly toss it to Bridget, but I've got a series of questions on the email line. I'm going to summarize them. Does aluminum, does arsenic, do the pollutants cause cancer? And is the reason that we've done so poorly is we've had both increased pollutants and increased, decreased physical activity, increased obesity, increased foods that stimulate cancer?
Sure. Well, cancer is really, in a lot of ways, a very natural process. You know, what happens is it's caused when even a few mutations within a single cell give that cell an advantage, a growth advantage over its neighbors. And so everything kind of gets out of whack at that point. But a lot of things can cause that genetic mutation. So part of that, it can be natural, like cell division, you know, just in the process of cells separating and their genome separating. But part of that can be caused by other things in our diet, in our environment, smoking, radiation. And so the level, the more we expose ourselves to these elements, the more likely for the unfortunate accident of cancer to happen. And that's really where we haven't done anything to prevent them. So yes, I can't speak specifically to aluminum, but arsenic, you know, is a known carcinogen. It's also, by the way, used in cancer treatment in some forms.
Bridget had a question. Go ahead.
Hi, Clifton. I was wondering, you talked a lot about how the U.S. spends so much on researching and treating the disease, and the problem actually that we're faced with right now stems from it's not that we don't have enough money to research and treat it, but it's rather that it's not being spent the right way. Can you expand upon that and explain your suggestions?
You know, I mean, this was probably the most provocative thing that I, found in my reporting over close to a decade, was everyone thinks, hey, it's just the money. If we only had more money, we'd be able to cure the war on cancer. We've been saying that we've been able to cure cancer. We've been saying that for decades. And in fact, we went from a budget of about $1.5 billion in 1972 to close to $31 billion today for the NIH. And yet researchers have about half the chance or less than half the chance of getting a research grant than they did 4 decades ago. And not only that, but we keep giving the money to the same people at the same tiny group of institutions over and over again. I mean, we talk about funding 3,000 institutions, but really only about 30 or 40 get any kind of money from the public taxpayer. So there's a lot of great ideas out there that just aren't being seen.
So how do you break that cycle?
Well, it's hard because the problem is that those investigators who are starving for funds, and there are lots of them, they say if you increase the size of the pie, we'll get a little bit more. Maybe we'll get a few dribbles from somebody else's slice. And, so they don't want you to change the system. They just want you to add more money. But we've been doing that for decades now, and there seems to be no amount of money that's enough. So my suggestion is to look at those things in the culture, in the academic culture, in the grantsmanship, in all of the ways we divvy up that money, and figure out how do we make this more effective. And in fact, we're not even opening up new investigative projects. We're just giving more money to existing projects. And so those projects are getting more expensive, but we're not getting more and more new ideas.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's tough. So you're focused.
I break it down in the book, and it's kind of frightening when you look at it, when you actually do the numbers and see who's getting what. It's just really disturbing.
So your focus on the book is how did we get here, and I read a little bit about your personal experience with Hodgkin's.
Yeah.
And is that what really motivated you, your initial interest in cancer?
You know, everyone asks that, and I should just start telling people yes, because it's so much more simple than the real answer. The real answer is, I was I'm a financial journalist. I was at Fortune, and I was executive editor of Fortune magazine, which is home of the Fortune 500, and I was convinced we were winning the war on cancer because I kept hearing about all this rhetoric, all this improvement we were making. Every week there was a new report of a quote breakthrough or an advance. And so I started to report that we were winning this war. But then as I started looking at the numbers, how many people were getting cancer, how many people were dying of it, what we were spending, it looked like there was this disconnect between the numbers and the rhetoric. And to me, that reminded me a lot of what the Wall Street scandals that I had been covering. Hey, wait a minute, companies are saying one thing, but the numbers are showing something else. And so I really approached it like a business story, trying to identify, who was telling the truth, what was really happening. And so I think it helped that I had cancer and that I had overcome it and been through that experience. But really, I see it more as being started as a reporter.
Let me say thank you, Clifton. The Truth in Small Doses is the book, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It, a brilliant expose and a brilliant discussion in the book. And thank you for a wonderful session talking about it with us. The website, CliftonLeaf.com. That's right, isn't it?
It is. Thank you so much, Dr. Mike. What a pleasure to be here with you and Bridget and your guests. I look forward to it again.
Thank you. We're now going to go to a Real Age Tip of the Week. And the tip this week is on, if you will, we're going to talk about, is your spouse driving you crazy? Marriage, of course, is like the internet. When it works, it's brilliant. And we, Dr. Oz and I, can't imagine life or living without either. But when there's a glitch in a happy marriage, which is almost inevitable, it makes you feel crazy because you know how good it can be. So for those moments when your marriage resembles Angry Birds, here's a remember why it's great for you list. One, because you'll live longer. Marriage extends guys' warranties for a longer life by as much as 30%. Because you won't gain a lot of post-divorce weight, because you'll enjoy life more, and because you can get some of your best exercise in bed. And that's the Real Age Tip of the Week.
Radio MD. Stay well.
Is your skin aging before your eyes? There is something you can do to reverse those signs of aging. I'm plastic surgeon Dr. Arthur Perry, and my solution doesn't involve a knife or a needle. It's a serum I created called Nighttime. Nighttime makes your skin smoother, brighter, and thicker with just one step each day. I've packed Nighttime with vitamins C and A, moisturizers, fruit acids, skin brighteners, and antioxidants. That's a lot of science in one bottle. But that's what it takes to make your skin look younger and more attractive. Until Labor Day, when you purchase two bottles of Nighttime, you'll get a third bottle free with free shipping. Call 855-940-1800. That's 855-940-1800, or on the web, it's drperrys.com. That's drperrys.com. Put the word Radio MD in the discount box to receive three bottles of Nighttime for the price of two.
You may already take omega-3s for heart and brain health, but what most people don't realize is that DHA is really the preferred form. Did you know if you take omega-3s, but your body cannot convert them into the preferred DHA form, you won't get much benefit? The ultimate DHA omega-3 would be water-soluble, so it's already in the right form for digestion. That's a game-changer. It would eliminate the fish burps, be good-tasting, and all-natural. It would be environmentally sustainable from algae oil, plus non-GMO and allergen-free. Well, I have some good news for you. Empirical Labs already invented this. And better yet, you can get a bottle right now for 50% off with a special offer at TakeOmega.com. This is the only water-soluble DHA supplement, plus it's vegan. So go to TakeOmega.com right now for a limited time savings, 50% off at TakeOmega.com. That's O-M-E-G-A. TakeOmega.com.